Psalm 143. It's a supplication of someone who's in a grave situation, persecuted by enemies. It becomes clear in verse 3. It's possible that he is to face judgment in the morning. That's when the judgment took place at the gate of the city. That's verse 8. And he's pleading with God to be there on his side. Like a vassal with his Lord, he relies on the faithfulness and justice of Yahweh. He's aware that he's not innocent, he'll say that. He's not without guilt. But he does deserve some punishment, but not losing his life. The threat against him is disproportionate to what he's done. So that's a comment. You might see that as you read the psalm too. And the psalm reads, "Hear my prayer, Yahweh. Be attentive to my supplications. In your faithfulness, answer me in your righteousness." Don't enter into judgment with your servant, for no one living is righteous in your sight. In other words, if you, God, enter into judgment, well, of course I'll be guilty, because you can see all, you know, none of us are perfect and all that. So don't you join the lot who are judging me. No one living is righteous in your sight. This expresses the central theme of the famous book of Job. And just to read one thing, how can a mortal be just before God? Proverbs picks that up too. Who can say, I have made my heart clean, I'm pure from my sin? Who can say that? Ecclesiastes, or Kohelet, the preacher, says, surely there's no one on earth so righteous as to do good without ever sinning. And Paul picks it up quite clearly in chapter 3 of the Romans. No human being will be justified in God's sight. One of the lovely things about this, I must say I learnt this very young. I got a very clear memory of this message. I was 24, I was just a priest, and I was just ordained and knew nothing except theology and philosophy and scripture and all this heady stuff, but I didn't know anything about life much. And of course, because I'd been, you know, in a seminary, in June, minor seminary, major seminary, novitiate, living in kind of a heavenly environment, but nothing like normal life. And this old priest that I can't remember his face now or name, but he came to confession to me. Shouldn't be telling what happens in confession, and I'm not going to. But I do remember him confessing the sin of pride. And I can remember two thoughts coming very quickly. One, and then another one came in straight against it. The first one was like a surprise, because he was the humblest priest I remember. I remember knowing that about him. He was a very humble priest. And I remember getting surprised just that he was confessing pride. But the second thought came straight away too, which was good. And I thought, well, of course that's the way it works. A proud person won't be confessing pride. Like, they won't even see it. A person who rides roughshod over people just by their character, they don't confess that, because they're not even aware of it. You know, boots coming in, boots and all. It's the really gentle person that picks up the slightest little bit of difference, and they'll come and say, you know, with their tender conscience, they'll say, look, I wasn't very gentle with the children today. And everyone else is looking at them thinking, God, they're absolutely angel of a dad or mum. But they are sensitive to pick that up. So it's the really humble person who confesses pride, because they pick up the slightest little movements of it. Wasn't I glad to get that thought at 24? Luckily, I mean, it's a nice thought. But it's obviously a true thought too. So now here I am still remembering at 68, that moment. But it's true. That's how it kind of works. So when none of us are sinless. And that's actually that's the nice part, by the way, of what I grew up in, and you maybe grew up in it too, of having the kind of regular confession not of mortal sin. They're pretty rare, I would have thought. But the little, just keeping tuned, our conscience tuned. Now, there's many other ways to do it, of course. But and it often didn't work the way the reconciliation sacrament used to be conducted. But still, there is something about regularly, in some way, having a look at our conscience, isn't there? So we don't drift into habits that get solid and we just don't know. And I look at other people that I know, talk about priests in my own order, and their character or their temperament, they're really good people, but they've got defects of character that are never really corrected. When I say they've got them, I'm not saying, you know. But because, you see, we don't have a wife to correct us, and we don't have teenage kids to correct us. So that's a big gap, isn't it? And father, like there could be, there isn't today, please God, but there can still be a little bit. So a priest can actually pick up quite bad habits without actually getting them corrected by someone who loves him closely enough to scratch his eyes out. And that's pretty hard to happen in ordinary life. And I don't mean just a priest. It can happen, you know, obviously everywhere. But I'm thinking it's a tragedy, really, because you get into these gruff habits or I know better than you habits or whatever it can be. And you can tell me later what my habits are that I'm acquiring. Hope you love me enough to correct me. But, yeah, I've said everything I think I want to say. We just need some kind of, some more than others if you're more alone in your life. More, not in a constant relationship in your life, you might need it more than other people, because some people do grow old gracefully and some people grow old grumpily, and no one's done them a favour by not correcting them. No one's doing them a favour by saying letting them go, but then you try and correct them and you get your head bitten off, so you've got to try and find a way around it. But it's not easy, obviously, but I would love to think people loved me enough to, even if it was hard, to do it. Because I think, yeah, people don't love you and they correct you, well, rightly, you should defend yourself because they don't know you. But if people actually love you and correct you, that's a big gift, isn't it? And it's a wonderful gift to have. And you always gain from it. Those of you who have people around you loving you all the time will know this better than... But, I mean, it is true. You always listen to advice that's given lovingly. When advice is given and it's the other person's agenda, you rightly either dismiss it or put it on hold, because it may well not be relevant. It may be talking about them, not about yourself. No human being is justified in God's sight. Verse 3, the enemy pursues me, crushing my life to the ground, making me sit in darkness like those long dead. My spirit, verse 4, faints within me. My heart within me is appalled. I remember the days of old. I think about all your deeds. I meditate on the works of your hands. I stretch out my hands to you. My soul thirsts for you like a parched land. That's pretty beautiful. Urgent. It's our main experience of the presence of God, I think, is longing. Not possession, of course, but a longing thing. Well, he's really longing and reaching out and attentive means that. Tendere means to stretch. So to be attentive means to be like a cat with a bird. You watch them and they're all, you know. So being attentive is being alert and ready to pick it up. Answer me quickly, Yahweh, my spirit fails. Don't hide your face from me, or I shall go down to the pit. I don't have to read all these, but there's a lot of... I've just given you... maybe I'll read some of them anyhow, just from other parts of the Bible, just to show you how common that image is about God revealing God's face. Well, God doesn't have a face. So you know it's metaphor, as all our words about God are all metaphor, so we don't want to fight over them too much. But God hiding God's face and God revealing God's face is clearly an image, isn't it, for experiencing the mystery of communion. in some way with God. So don't hide your face. Don't leave me without knowing in some way that you're with me. Well, here we've got some other ones here. Psalm 28, if you are silent to me, I'll go down like those who go down to the pit. Psalm 13, how long, Yahweh, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? Was read that years ago, but was told it by some dear fellow priest that I died a few years ago, but a very lovely man. Left the priesthood, in fact, but never stopped being a priest. Had a kind of a tortured life, but highly intelligent and poetic, and spent his, he couldn't, caring for everybody. And when he left the priesthood, he did even more of caring for everybody than he did as a priest. It's all very mysterious, isn't it, our life? What happens in marriages and what happens in priesthood and what... We've got to just love everybody and let them work their life out. But he was the one who said this to me. I remember, and it struck me that our main experience of God is the experience of the absence of God. And I'm sure that's right. But when you think about that, if you experience someone's absence, if they're absent and you've got nothing to do with them, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about experiencing absence. And you know yourself, when there's someone close to you who's overseas or somewhere, if you experience their absence, it's a very intense experience of closeness, isn't it? Because you're actually experiencing that they're not here, and you kind of... So that's how it is with our... I think our experience of God is... That's pretty well put the finger on it. For most of the time, it's the experience of absence, but a longing. And you can't be experienced as absent unless you're very present to someone. He also said, this same priest, that there's, and one of the main problems he reckoned was over faith. People believe too much. I'm sure he's right on that too. We've got to cut our faith right down to real, what we really believe. A few rock bottom things that we believe. Because look at the world and look at all the things that people believe and say behave badly. Look at all the images of God that are around that are absolutely balmy and bad and pretentious and stubborn and fighting. And look at all the people we've burnt at the stake because we believed in God. We'd have done better to have no faith at all. You know, I'm exaggerating, but the things that we believe get us into a hell of a lot of trouble. So we've got to pare it right down and be honest about it and say, no, I don't believe that, I don't believe that, I don't believe that, that's not right, that's... Do you know? And get down to what we actually do believe, because it'll be good. I think he's right there too. The problem of over-faith is a massive one in our world. So Psalm 27... Come, my heart says, seek his face. Your face, Lord, do I seek. Don't hide your face from me. Don't turn your servant away in anger. You who have been my help, do not cast me off. Do not forsake me, O God, of my salvation. There's many more. Psalm 69, do not hide your face from your servant, for I am in distress. Make haste to answer me. Draw near to me. Redeem me. Set me free from my enemies. So it's obviously a common image, and it means, let me know in some way that you care for me. Make your presence experienced by me. So the psalm then, verse 8.
Do you think this is very funny? Jesus on the cross quoted, or went back to him and said, oh God, why hast thou forsaken me?
Well, he was precisely quoting Psalm 22, wasn't he? So, yes, it's another, it's the same idea that's throughout here. Thank you. So verse 8, and concluding our psalm, let me hear of your kindness in the morning. In the morning. Why in the morning? Is that because that's when the judgment is taking place? I think so. It's likely. For in you I put my trust. Teach me the way I should go, for to you I lift up my soul. Save me, Yahweh, from my enemies. I have fled to you for refuge. Teach me to do your will, for you are my God. Let your good spirit lead me on a level path. For your name's sake, Yahweh, preserve my life. In your righteousness, bring me out of trouble. In your kindness, cut off my enemies and destroy all my adversaries, for I am your servant.